Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's guest finds inspiration in what other people throw away. Rebecca Strelick is a professor of visual arts at Penn State Altoona and the 2016-2017 Penn State Laureate. She describes herself as a rescuer of objects that are underappreciated. Her sculptural jewelry, which is prized on and off the body, is fueled by yard sales and made using 3D printing. Rebecca Strelick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patty.
You are this year's Penn State Laureate, something that was created at Penn State in 2008 to honor individual professors for their work and to create greater visibility for the arts and humanities. And I think that you have been a phenomenal representative for Penn State. Tell us a bit about your gig as the Penn State Laureate.
Oh, and it's been some gig. I have spent the year visiting all of the Commonwealth campuses throughout the Penn State system, speaking about my work and my teaching, my collaborations with unexpected players like engineers through an NSF grant. And the wonderful thing is that you go out to some of these campuses that are relatively small, doing wonderful things, and maybe they don't have an art program or even art professors. So you get to show up and kind of share what you do and be a resource for them, which is wonderful.
Well, what's sort of interesting is what's actually here in terms of arts, because some of the things that you're doing in your studio and in your lab, you would expect to be happening in New York City.
Just because of the technology, you mean?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's becoming more ubiquitous. I mean, 3D printing started really in the early 80s. And at that point, you could really get your hands on it with arranging through industry. You couldn't walk up to a printer per se. But these days, it's everywhere. You have elementary school students, public libraries. The Altoona Public Library has a 3D printer. So it's really much more accessible now. And so what becomes more interesting is that when you bring in an artist, and what they're doing with 3D printing, they're going to come up with different answers than what you'd get from, say, the public or product designers or engineers.
Which is kind of why there are more and more people wanting to collaborate with an artist. You mentioned engineers a moment ago, and you are working on something that sounds really fascinating. It's working on origami, and there are applications for that in healthcare and in other fields. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. So about 5 years ago now, I was approached to be on a proposal team for a National Science Foundation grant. And this grant was unusual in that it was one of the first times that the NSF required an artist to be on the grant team, and not just in a consultative role. So often the NSF will suggest that the team go and speak with an artist or just touch base with them.
In fact, you're the co-investigator.
Right. So that was the difference. They required this artist, me, to actually be a named investigator on the project. So with the same recognition and resources that anybody else would be on, which was wonderful. So now that you're fully fledged, now you're going to have to figure out what you're doing, because it's uncommon for a visual artist to be on an NSF grant. And so we spent a great deal of time on the uptake to figure out what our common vocabularies were. And once we did, like you mentioned, we were trying to use origami as the inspiration, kind of the very basic foundation to solve problems of compliant mechanisms. And compliant mechanisms is a very fancy way of saying smart materials. So things that bend and fold without you touching them.
And what you're really working on is something like being able to insert into the human body a tool that will unfold so that surgery can be less invasive.
Right. Not something I had thought I'd be working on when I was in art school at all.
But you are a problem solver.
Sure.
So I have to go back a little bit, because you are a renowned jewelry artist. Your work, it's been exhibited more than 65 times. It's in permanent collections in some pretty impressive museums around the country. And your focus right now is computer-aided design. But you originally trained as a traditional bench jeweler in metals. How and why did you make this transition?
I know, it's a great question. So I was at Tyler School of Art, which is Temple University's art school, and I bounced around a bunch. I was almost every major at the art school. Painting, fibers. I was glass for a few weeks. I just loved everything. And every time I met a new professor, I was inspired by them, and I wanted to be them and do everything they do. So every time I got to a new class, I was like, oh, I guess I have to redeclare my major again. And when I landed in metals, what I found that it was this beautiful combination of all the things I was loving from the other areas. And it was very scalable, so you could make very teeny tiny things or very large things in metal. I liked the danger and the challenge component of it, meaning that you could melt things, like you could make metal move with tools and heat, and that was just magical. And so I really loved it in there. I also, not going to lie, I love the idea that I could make things that people in my life found inherently valuable just because of what it was. A perfect example, like I could make Christmas presents for my mother, right? I could make her a gold ring for Christmas. And that was not something I was finding an immediate connection to in some of the other fine arts. So this idea that the crafts, this idea of academic crafts, you could make the objects that function was really attractive. But your question about how I ended up where I was, so I was in that program, and it was right about my junior year that a faculty member, the head of the program, his name is Stanley Lexin, and if you want to talk about world-renowned, he is in every textbook.
I read about him, yes.
I mean, he's it. Made a new requirement in the degree program that we had to take a computer-aided design class. So I'm bopping along soldering and making jewelry, and all of a sudden that next semester I had to meet in a computer lab, and that made zero sense to me. And actually, I was not very pleased about it, and I made that pretty well known. I was kind of the worst student you'd ever want, and if I ever got me in a class, I would just, yes. Anyway, so I ended up in this class, and I was really annoyed that I had to push a mouse around for 3 hours, and I think it was about 6 to 8 weeks in, I was doing a project, and Stanley was like hovering behind me, and he probably wouldn't remember this, but I can remember it like it was yesterday, and I was trying to make a linkage, just like any link you've ever seen, a chain link, and I was trying to pass these two kind of ring forms through, I was opening them up and trying to close them together to make this linkage, and he just starts laughing, and I already didn't want to be there, so then when your professor starts laughing at you, it just kind of compounds just the awfulness. And I looked back at him and I was like, what's the deal? Why are you laughing at me? And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, your assignment is what I'm doing. He's like, no. They can just pass through one another.
You know, it's the difference between linear and nonlinear editing. So I get exactly where you were at that moment.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, so the light bulb must have gone off.
And this terrible thing happened where I was so excited because this, like my brain had cracked open. I had all these possibilities all of a sudden. And where in the studio, the traditional studio, I was falling short because I didn't want to spend a lifetime learning how to set stones. I didn't want to be expert in one little thing. I wanted to be good at everything. And so I found very quickly that, oh my goodness, if I get good at this way of making, I can make anything. My hand on the mouse that I hated so much was actually my bridge into making forms that I physically couldn't make because of my skill or interest or just who I was. And it really opened up everything. So I simultaneously cheered in my head and grumbled at him because I came to it by such an awkward trajectory that it was just my aha moment. Like I stopped and the light bulb went off and that changed my path for the rest of my artistic career.
And you had wanted to be an artist for as long as you were old enough to even think about the possibility of a career.
Yeah. I mean, I was so lucky. I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia and in Bucks County, and the school district just had a really rich arts environment to the point where I can remember spending lunches in the art room as young as elementary school. That was a choice you could make. And junior high, you could kind of focus on art, and I could stay after school and work with my art teachers and help them. I mean, just cleaning out supply closets of paint excited me. I mean, they just saw it as free labor, but I was getting my hands on all of these wonderful things and tools was just enough to make me want to stay there instead of go home. And then through high school, I did really focus on art. It just all made sense. I mean, it all just kind of fell in because of how wonderful the educational system was set up to support me.
I want to talk about the future of the arts a little bit later on, but first I want to talk about your inspiration because you are the collector of some very odd stuff, everything from AstroTurf to people's used retainers, 100 champagne corks. They've been marked with important dates in a family's life, and for some reason you have them.
Yes. I am, you used the right word, I am the rescuer. I'm the one, I troll thrift stores and yard sales. I mean, I've climbed into dumpsters in people's trash. In Philly, they don't really like you doing that when I live there. And so I'd get shooed away quite a bit from the police. But my husband and I still have things in our home that we trash picked. It was just what we did for fun. But these days, you know, I live in Hollidaysburg, right outside of Altoona. And there's so many wonderful pockets of rich histories in that area, families that have been there for a very long time. So parts of their lives end up in the trash or at the thrift store.
It's kind of sad.
It's sad, but at the same time, it's like my library. It's where I go.
It's your archive.
That's right. It is. And some days you completely strike out, and some days I take multiple trips to the car because I have to go back in and get the things that are still waiting for me at the counter. And, you know, you mentioned the champagne corks, and that's still one of my most prized finds. I mean, it was literally just a bucket full of hundreds of champagne corks with the wire rims still on. And a family had written every occasion that those bottles were open for and dated them. And there were marriages and there were deaths and there were graduations and births and birthdays. And I mean, I literally, you can lay them all out and see
a life,
decades of a family's life. And I was standing there in the Altoona Salvation Army holding these corks, crying, because I felt so fortunate to be bestowed upon this history. And I just, I can't imagine any other way to honor things that are pitched. It's more than trash to treasure. It really is about how you mark time and events.
But the interesting thing is that you are not going to make a necklace that has these corks hanging from it. These are really to inspire you to do something totally different.
Right.
Explain that process.
It's hard to explain sometimes. It's easier to explain once I have finished, right? So I have the cork sitting in my studio for 2 years, looking at them every single day, trying to make something that aspires to the level of emotion they evoked in me. So when I was standing there in that thrift store and I felt the need to tear up because of this history, that's what I need to make in a new object, in something of contemporary materials that speaks to my time and marks my occasions.
Well, maybe a good example would be, I'm looking right now at you and I'm looking at this really magnificent brooch that you have on you. This is called the Army Green Orchid. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really great stories behind it. It was inspired by a number of things that sort of collided. Your brother being in the military, hence the olive drab green.
That's right.
And the orchid from a magazine that you saw at the checkout of someone who had ordered, you know, literally $1 million worth of orchids for her wedding. Tell us a little bit about what you've created and why.
Right. So you're absolutely right. So that checkout story, I was in the grocery store and I picked the longest line sometimes just for the fact of being able to look at those tabloid magazines that I will never buy. And I was flipping through one and found an article about a bride who not only purchased expensive flowers, she had a team of botanists in helicopters go to harvest them off of a mountainside in Belize.
Because they were only alive for a couple
yes.
of hours.
And so each wedding party member had to have multiple versions because they would die, which I just think is the funniest, like, symbolic entity. You know, you're going to go get married, and meanwhile, these dying flowers keep getting replaced off the people celebrating your wedding. It's so very
incongruous.
Yes. And so that, in combination with this idea of preciousness. So you mentioned my brother, Jonathan, my younger brother. He went into the military. And, you know, I was in art school when he went into the military. I had some very specific ideas about what I thought my younger brother should be doing. Many of which were based on assumptions that I knew nothing about. It turned out my brother being in the Army was the best thing for him. He's a super, super smart guy and has gone on to have an amazing career as a mathematician. And he was entering the Army and I was afraid for him. I was scared. I didn't want anything bad to happen to him. And I was looking for some way to make a piece about that feeling that I had harped on so much verbally with him, and it wasn't going any further. So I needed to somehow mark it in an object, which is what I do. And I couldn't find the vehicle. And it wasn't until I found that article about that bride that I realized, like, oh, like the corks kind of marking things in time in a family history, that bride gave me an object to place my feelings about my brother. And that was in the form of these lasting corsages. So basically this kind of stick it to you to that bride to say, here, I'm going to make you something that doesn't have to die, that I get to place my feelings about my brother and preciousness within. So yeah, that's where that came from.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Rebecca Strelick, a professor of visual arts at Penn State and this year's Penn State laureate. Strelick has been using 3D technologies in her work since 1999. I want to go back to that brooch because the former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who actually has a brooch collection, has one of your Army Green Orchids in her collection.
She does.
How exciting.
So exciting, because really the sense of value within the work itself mirrors so much of what I feel about this woman in history. I mean, Madeleine Albright was one of the first female politicians as I was growing up and becoming aware of politics and my place within them. It was one of the first person I could look to and say, oh, here's a woman doing it in a very respectful, strong way that I just admire so much. So the fact that one of my pieces about some of these ideas, the military and values and what things are worth, you know, ended up in her collection was just, it allowed it to come full circle. It was just really wonderful.
And not just in her collection. She's written a book, Pin, Stories from a Diplomat's Jewel Box, and she talks about how she chooses pins to sort of communicate and also to sort of protect her depending upon the event or what she was called to do. Why did she wear your pin? What event?
Well, the event that she received the pin was wonderful. She came to speak at Penn State Altoona. My chancellor at the time, Chancellor Bechtel-Wary, she called me into her office a couple weeks before the night of the event, and she said, you know, Madeleine Albright's coming. I said, yeah, I'm really excited. She's like, you know, she has a brooch collection. And I said, yeah. jewelry major, right? I knew about her collection, but yes, I do. She's like, well, the college would like to gift her one of your pieces. And that's fine. I mean, once a famous person says they collect something, they just get tons of them in the mail. So she is like a warehouse somewhere with all these brooches. But really when it hits home for an artist is when that piece gets borrowed to be placed somewhere in an exhibition. So years later, after we gave her that piece, the Museum of Arts and Design borrowed it back for an exhibition called Out of Hand. So that's really when you get to list it, is when it's in the museum on the wall and next to the piece on the placard says, generous thanks to the former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And you're like, oh, yeah, that actually happened. That wasn't really just in my head. So that's why it ended up with her. It was this really nice confluence of events that just kind of all stacked together to allow her to have that piece.
You know, speaking of brooches, Madeleine Albright isn't the only one to wear them. In investigating your story, I read a great story about a pin that was worn by Hillary Clinton. She had a silver broccoli pin, which she wore in a debate with George H.W. Bush because she knew he was a broccoli hater. and that now is also in the National Archives.
Yeah, how about? I mean, I've been talking about a lot of this when my laureate visits, right? So I think on first glance, when someone sees the word jewelry, they jump to whatever is the most common definition in their own mind. And maybe it's a necklace they bought at a mall 2 weeks ago to match their shoes. And that's completely legit. And I'm glad they chose to spend their money on something to adorn their person. I am all for that. But as an educator, I really push my students as young artists to not just make things that are pretty, because we have lots of pretty. We have an overabundance of pretty in this world. And that's fine. But if you can make it pretty and, or make it challenging and, or make it ugly and following that and is something along the lines of, can you teach us something or tell us something, or really just illuminate the world in a way that is slightly askew or different so that someone stops for just a moment to reconsider what they thought.
Well, that makes me wonder why your work is jewelry to begin with. I mean, it can be worn and it is worn and it looks terrific on your shoulder right now. But I think of the power of art, and I think of, you know, Picasso's Guernica or Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial. And you seem to be communicating with jewelry what those artists have communicated with paintings or with sculptures.
Wow. That was a nice little short list to be included in just then, Patty. Thank you. I'm not sure if my stuff has reached that power, but at the same time, I think this comes out of my educational background, and that is my foundation is in the crafts. And the whole premise behind the crafts is to meet skill with intent and idea to result in an object that functions, right? And, you know, there's lots of, depending on who you're speaking with in the art world, they'll define different art movements in different ways. But this idea of function in that, first and foremost, the pieces I make need to be wearable. They won't function as jewelry if they're so heavy they pull your chest to the ground. They really need to function first. And if I check that box, then I feel like, well, now that it's sitting there doing nothing on your body, I might as well teach you something. And that's when I start to embed all these stories in there. I find it really important. I'm kind of a didactic person in that I'm constantly wanting to explain things to people, not because I think I need to, but because I so enjoy learning new things. And when someone opens up a new box of the world for me and I didn't realize it was that way, that's one of the most rewarding experiences. The fact that I can try to help do that with other people is why I do.
Well, this educator part of you brings me to some work that you did that started with bear teeth and this idea that the way we can figure out how old a bear is has to do with their teeth, and you used that information and married it with your own school pictures of you yourself aging. Really
yep.
Fascinating. So, my goodness, you can learn quite a bit just looking at sort of the self-portrait of you and these bears.
I know,
bear
I know.
Teeth.
So I spent a couple of years working on this idea of bears. And again, this was one of, like, my visiting of yard sales. I was with a dear friend, my best friend, and we were on a canoe trip. In the evenings during the trip, we were treated to these lectures, just these local lectures. And one of them was the Fish and Boat Commission. And a gentleman came in and he gave us this literally a slide lecture with a slide tray about Pennsylvania black bear. And he went really quickly past this idea of how you age a bear. If a bear is encroaching on human spaces, they tend to want to not keep that bear around so it doesn't harm people. So they'll put the bear gently to sleep, and then they'll do some tests on it. They'll pull one of its teeth, which is not super nice. But in so doing, that tooth is sent to a lab, probably a lab in Bozeman, Montana, with Gary Mattson, who I had the pleasure of spending some time with during my research. He was wonderful, who taught me all about cementum age analysis. And here we go again, like, I have no business talking about Pennsylvania black bear or this biological scientific process. But again, it's me as an artist seeing this correlation between what I wanted to say and needing to find some kind of data point or scientific process to back it up. And so I kind of used it in the wrong order, but I found a way, a vehicle to get my ideas about time. And I did work about fertility and my own, you're right, my own teeth and how they were a hot mess for a long time when I was little. And so I used that as the vehicle to depict these ideas.
You know, I think of the educational philosopher Maxine Green, who said, art can't change the world, but it can change someone who can.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I have to ask, really, as an artist, what do you think your purpose is? Why are artists important?
Well, I think one of the main premise, and if I talk about all artists in the world, I mean, we're really the mirrors, right? So when things are going sideways and we don't know how to talk about stuff, and I think right now is a really good example in our history, artists are the ones in all forms, whether they're writers or they're acting or whatever they're doing, we're the ones who just turn the mirror back on society and say, do you see what you're doing? And in some cases, that can be included with shock. It could be something that's hard to look at. But throughout time, that's what the artist's role has been. On a more kind of local or acute sense, as an educator in Altoona, Pennsylvania, I think my role is really to give the right kind of power and energy to these young people to go out and do the thing you just said. So I don't expect all my students to leave and go on to graduate school and make living by making artwork, but I do expect them to be excellent problem solvers. And it just so happens the way they're coming at problems is with an artist's eye. And so I really want them to leave, and regardless of what career path they choose, they're able to enter in and say, you know what? I've never done that before, but I have done this and it looks similar. So now I can figure out how to do it in these ways. The degree program we teach at Penn State Altoona is unique in the Penn State system. It's called Visual Arts Studies. And we don't expect a student to kind of have this Bauhaus approach of getting all the basics and getting more and more and more specific till you're expert in something. We actually liken it more to like a big oak tree, where we start at a trunk, which is a little bit more constrained, and we open them up so that students are really generalists, which I think comes with a little bit of negativity in academia sometimes. But we want them to be strong generalists. So whether they're working for a hospital or a playhouse, or they're making their work by day and doing something else by night, that they really are able to approach any problem and come at it at an angle that is not only unique, but can serve many disciplines. So we want our students to be able to work well with lots of different kinds of people.
And that gets me back to this 3D printing and technology. You talked about, you know, 3D printing really coming of age or coming on the scene in the 1980s, and that you grew up with it. And so
yeah.
I'm wondering today, just how flexible does it make an artist?
Well, I mean, I think it's like anything else. So I try to be careful to say that 3D printing is a be-all or end-all to anything, right? In my mind, 3D printing is another methodology of making. And when I used to be making things in gold and silver, now I'm making them in bits and bytes on a computer. There's really little different except of the specific tools you're using and how you think about moving forms through space. I mean, I really think that it opens up so much problem solving in terms of anything you need, you can make. And it's magical kind of to see, like, I have two small kids and my six-year-old, she kind of thinks that anything that breaks in the house or anything that goes missing, I can just go and push a button and this thing will reappear. Like, she thinks we have like a replicator in the house, right? In reality, we have a lab on campus that I could spend a few hours on trying to repair things, and I have. But they're growing up at a time where this is the way things are done.
In fact, you say someday they're going to say, tomorrow it's Christmas dinner and I want a serving for eight with a Christmas pattern on it.
Yeah, and press a button next to your dishwasher and you're going to have your own dish set come out. I mean, your closets will be smart closets. You'll have very little things in there. You want those shoes? You just go buy them from Amazon. But instead of them showing up in the mail, they're going to be printed. It's headed that way in a lot of ways, which I think for some people they think is really scary. But, you know, if we look at the tide of many technologies over the ages, they always came with this wave of fear of what would be lost.
But it sort of goes back to this throwaway society that we were talking about first and that inspires so much of your work.
Right. And I think that's why it's a weird dichotomy, right? Here's this artist, me, who I'm using these high technologies to build things out of new smart materials with engineers. And yet I'm dumpster diving for things that were made only a certain way and are no longer. So I'm pining and holding on to this idea of quality and legacy that I think the objects that are coming out every day don't have, because it is this idea that you use it once and you throw it away. So that's my challenge as an artist. How can I use this technology of this time, my time, 3D printing, which I liken to be like my next door neighbor because we grew up together, right? We happened at the same times. And so how do I use that technology to make things that have those same qualities? Even though this is plastic, the thing I'm wearing today, will I want to wear it forever and give it to my daughter? And will she give it to her daughter?
Well, speaking of that, you actually inherited, before your grandmother passed, she gave you a box of her costume jewelry.
Yeah.
You're not a real big jewelry wearer. Mm-mm. You wear a wedding ring and occasionally you'll put on the brooch that you made, for example. But otherwise, you're not someone who wears it every day. But you made this decision throughout your time as the Penn State laureate to wear a different piece of your grandmother's jewelry. And you called this project 365 grams, which is what you called your grandmother.
Yeah, my gram.
Have you figured out yet what you're going to do with,
I have
that experience?
I'm trying to stay really disciplined because it's itchy for me. Like, I want to start right now, but I'm on day 292 today. I actually wore this pair of my grandmother's earrings. So every day I'm wearing a pair of her earrings or a necklace or a brooch. And I said this at a talk recently that I think where I'm headed is about half of these pieces are going to be completely obliterated. They are going to be dismantled and destroyed because...
And made into something else.
Something else. I'm going to redefine them in some crazy way. And then the ones that are very, very precious, I'm going to destroy virtually. So I will 3D scan them and I will capture their form data in a computer-aided design environment and then I'll destroy them virtually. And then when I exhibit them, what I'm planning on doing is showing the original piece next to what I've made from it. So a very direct interpretation of this collection, a life, really, my Graham's life, which is just, it's such a huge project, and I'm equally scared and overly excited, so I'm looking forward to beginning.
I can't wait to see what you do. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure, Patty. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Rebecca Strelick, a professor of visual arts at Penn State and this year's Penn State laureate. She combines art, computer-aided design, three-dimensional modeling, and rapid prototyping to create wearable works of art. To see some of her work and to hear her perspective on the state of arts funding under this new administration, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.